You may know that I teach a weekly Parsha class here at Ikar in Los Angeles every Thursday at noon, Pacific time. You're welcome. We've got folks joining us virtually from places as far away as Japan on Zoom. And we've been archiving video edits of the classes on YouTube, but we thought we might try cutting down the 1 hour class to about 40 minutes for you, for the listeners of the Best Book Ever podcasts that might not be able to fit a midday class on a Thursday into your schedule. So I hope you enjoy listening to these as much as I enjoy teaching them. If you're interested to attend the class from wherever you are in the world in person, then stick around at the end of the podcast. I'll tell you how to register. Just like the podcast, it's absolutely free, and we'd love to have you. Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Nice to see you all. We are back in the Torah. We are back in Leviticus. And last week we took a little break because we were coming up on Purim and we read another of our sacred scriptures, the Book of Esther. And it's important to do that. It's important to study that book also. It is also a masterpiece, and we did that because we were leading up to Purim. But I had in mind also. I just want to say that I had in mind that we also were able to do that to sort of, so to speak, take a week off because this week is a lot of what we saw last week in the Torah itself. So we start the book of Leviticus in the first two readings are nearly identical. They describe the offerings as they would be brought from the perspective of the person bringing the offering, and then this week we describe really all of those same offerings. But now from the perspective of the priest that would be taking them. So it's mostly the same thing. We used to have a joke about this when I was working at a shul. Like, if you got tapped to speak on Parshat Tzav, you were stuck because it's like there's nothing to talk about. Like it's hard enough to talk about last week's parsha because it's all the details of the sacrifices, and now we're just basically doing it all over again. So it's like, what do you talk about on Parshat Tzav? In fact, my last sermon at Ikar was on Parshat Tzav, and I felt like, oh, this is fitting. I have to make something of Parshat Tzav. Okay, so all of that is to say that this is difficult stuff, not just because it's repetitive, but also. It's difficult stuff to begin with. The sacrifices are difficult, I think, for us, for modern readers. And that's mostly what I want to talk about today is the disconnect that we feel with the sacrifices. And because we have this sort of extra week, so to speak, to reflect on them, what I want to do, I went back and looked at classes I've taught, and I thought, have we ever studied this before? This particular piece from Maimonides on the sacrifices. And I don't think we have in this class before. We have studied many debates between Maimonides, the 11th century, or I want to say 12th century scholar, great, maybe the greatest philosophical thinker in Judaism, a debate between him and his frequent sparring partner, though he didn't know it. It's his sparring partner by way of commenting on him, Nachmanides. We refer to Moses ben Maimon as Maimonides and Moses ben Nachman as Nachmanides. And there you're going to see a very classic, a very important debate between the two of them today. And I hope it'll help us in this extra week that we have to think about the sacrifices, to really think about what do we do with these sacrifices, and how do we relate to them in an age where And here I come to the point. Not only do we not have a temple and sacrifices, that's the rabbi's challenge. One-fifth of the Torah is no longer relevant. What do we do? One-fifth meaning the book of Leviticus. But I think the other problem for us is that we don't want sacrifices. Like we have left that period. So it's been such a long time that no longer seems like it no longer seems like a good way to serve God. And it also no longer seems like a good thing to do to animals, right? So there's lots of trouble we have with the sacrifices. And I want today to look at really absolutely one of the classic responses, which will, I think, force some big questions about the entire Torah, right? Which we'll sort of process as we go. We're like, what do we do with the sacrifices? And once you see what Maimonides does the sacrifices, the question becomes, well, can he do that with anything? But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's take a quick break and say a blessing. I have a couple of announcements, really just one. Well, first of all, I try to give the piece that I wrote for Hadar in the chat at the beginning. And here is what I wrote for Hadar, which was all about one notation above one word. And you can see I wrote 10 pages about one notation and one word. So that is, I'm not going to take you through all of that again, but that's if you're interested. And the notation, by the notation, I mean the tam, the cantillation, the trope. And there's a very special trope on one of the words in this week's Parsha. So if you're interested, go take a look at that. And all I can say is the essay that I wrote is related to the class that we're going to do today, but not in all of its details, but just in its well, you'll see if you read it. We're reflecting on the same questions of what do we do with all these sacrifices? Okay. And the other announcement that I wanted to make, if for those of you who are in LA, I wanted to just tell you that Hadar, I am Hadar in LA, and Stiebel, the Stiebel Minion, are going to have basically a nigun circle, a sort of song circle, but we're calling it a tish because a tish means table in Yiddish. And there's a tradition, a Hasidic tradition, of gathering on Friday night and sitting around a table and singing together and then learning together a little bit. We're going to do it on Wednesday night. That is this coming Wednesday. And we're going to do it where Stiebel meets at the Workman's Circle on Robertson. And everybody's welcome to join. It's free. And I should say Antonia Lasser, who some of you know, is going to be leading the singing. She's very skilled at that. And I'm going to be doing a little teaching. So there's an event there, not every Wednesday night, this Wednesday night. And hopefully in my work so far, people are asking me like, what has Hadar done so far in since you started? And my answer has been, I don't know. I have nothing yet. I'm just getting my sea legs here. But the truth is what we have done so far is we started a little pop-up Beit Midrash on the east side of in Highland Park, which meets on every first Thursday of the month. And I'm excited about that. We've been doing some Beit Midrash learning in San Francisco also. So that's what we've done so far. And now I really want to start something that speaks to another major wing of Hadar's operations, which is its musical wing. And so, and just, not just for Hadar's sake, but because I think Hadar has these spheres of activity, learning and music, because these are really important ways for us to connect together as a Jewish people, as a community, through Torah and through song. I find those to be, those to be essential Jewish practices. So anyway, would love to see you next Wednesday. And with that, let's say a blessing together over our Torah study. And we'll get started today looking at some very important and I should say some very difficult material as well. Okay, and I'll warn you as we get to the more and more difficult stuff. One of the cases we'll look at is particularly challenging. Okay, let's say a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Kidshanu B'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu La'Asok B'Divrei Torah. Okay. All right, here we go. So we're going to take a look at this piece, as I said, from Maimonides. I'm going to give it to you now. And it's from Maimonides' major philosophical work, the Guide for the Perplexed, and Guide to the Perplexed, Guide for the Perplexed, Mora Nevuchim, it's called. And this is the book that Maimonides is famous for outside of Judaism. This is how Maimonides became a name that you would hear in the halls of philosophy departments. Inside of Judaism, Maimonides is much more famous for his legal work, the Mishneh Torah, his summary basically of the entire Talmud. And there's a lot of, I just saw someone talking about this recently. Is the philosophical Maimonides the same as the legalist Maimonides? Not the same person, everybody agrees the same person, but are they basically two kinds of characters? And one was his sort of worldly character where he speculated and dealt with ideas that were like non-traditional, and one was his, you know, serious Jewish side moving through the law. And I say that because what he's about to say here in the more philosophical work, Mora Nevuchim, about the sacrifices, is something that that might sound like it's coming from outside of the tradition, that it is that it is a kind of a critical almost approach to the tradition. Let me, without talking about it further, show you a little bit what I mean. But he is dealing with, you don't need a whole lot of context here. He's dealing with the sacrifices, and he's dealing with the question of why we have sacrifices. Why do we have sacrifices? And, you know, maybe I should have paused before we even went into the material and just asked you, well, how do you feel about the sacrifices? But I guess I'm not going to do that because I'm sort of assuming that most of us are not wild about the ideal of animal sacrifice. Maybe some of you have a more a deeper, a more sympathetic, a greater appreciation for the sacrifices, and that perspective will also be welcome in this conversation. We will hear some of those voices as well, of those who are defending the sacrifices. But Maimonides is about to say something about them that I think, if you haven't seen it before, has the potential to reshape your whole vision of the Torah. So let's take a look here. And it was a long passage. I started retranslating it, and then I got about halfway through and I got tired of retranslating it. So you may see some archaic language and some he pronouns for God and all that kind of stuff that I usually translate out. But let's take a look here. All right, here we go. Guide for the Perplexed. Okay, and this is, in some ways, his big principle is his first statement. So we, you know, we're, I don't know if we're going to read all of this. This is like a lot of material, but the first sentence is enough for us to get the gist of what he is saying and his answer to what the sacrifice is all about. V'hu she'i efshar letzeit min ha'hefech el ha'hefech pitom. It is impossible to go suddenly from one extreme to the other. Okay, this is a human nature thing, which is why I was playing that Michael Jackson song. Human nature. It is therefore, according to the nature of a human, impossible for him to suddenly discontinue everything to which he has been accustomed. Now, I just want to say, that's a big statement. That's a strong statement. It is impossible for human beings to suddenly go from one extreme to the other. You can't expect that of them. You can't expect that of them. That means you can't just tell people who are, you know, who are doing bad to start doing good. Okay? Can't tell people who are worshiping this God to suddenly start worshiping an entirely different entity. Okay? Like, this is what he's alluding to in the context of the sacrifices, but he just makes this basic statement about human nature. It's impossible to go from one extreme to the other. So I want you already to be thinking, do you agree with Maimonides? Is that true? Is he's going to make a claim. It's impossible for a person to just change, and not just a person, but a nation. So let's see, how does that play into the sacrifices? Well, God sent Moses to make the Israelites a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, okay? We are supposed to be this great, exalted, new form of worship, religion, acknowledgement of the oneness of God. And God is giving us this through Moses. God's giving us a Torah, which gives us the knowledge of God. Now we know that God is one, that God is a singular force, that God created the universe, that there is only one God. And we know that, and now we can stop worshiping all of these silly other deities, right? Isn't that the way we often tell the Jewish story? Like, you know, Abraham discovered that there was one God, and then, you know, for the rest of our history, we've been, you know, railing against all of these false idols. Okay, but remember, that isn't exactly how it worked. It's not like Abraham suddenly started the Jewish religion. The Jewish religion, as a whole religion that we think of it today, doesn't start until Moses. And so Moses is the one that gets all these actual laws. Okay, so when Moses gets the laws, what's the situation in the world? And this is how Maimonides makes his case. The custom back then, Vayaha Minhag Hamufursam Ba'olam, the famous custom in the world, the general custom in the world in those days, and the general mode of worship in which Israelites were brought up, it's just the world they lived in, consisted in sacrificing animals in those temples which contained certain images, to bow down before those images and to burn incense before them. Religious and ascetic persons were in those days the persons that were devoted to the service in the temples erected to the stars, as has been explained by us. In other words, I've told you about this before. Back in the day, there were temples and they worshiped planets and stars and the sun and the moon and all kinds of non-monotheistic things. Okay. It was in accordance with the wisdom and plan of God, as displayed in the whole creation, that God did not command us to give up and to discontinue all these manners of service, for to obey such a commandment, it would have been contrary to the nature of man, of human, who generally cleaves to that to which he is used, that which he is used to. It would in those days have made the same impression as a prophet would make at the present. Okay, wait, hold on. Okay, I don't want to continue too much more. He makes several points, and there's a whole big chunk of text, so let's not get lost, or let me not get you lost. Let's just start with that first premise, and what a premise, and let's talk about it for a minute. What do we agree with Maimonides, who, now you have the gist of the argument. You can't ask people who only know sacrificial worship. That was the way of the world. You cannot ask people to suddenly start to just give it all up. You just can't do that, because that would be too abrupt for them. They just wouldn't be able to go from one extreme to the other. So as a general principle, I'm curious if that makes sense to you. Do you think that it's true that if sacrifice is the way of the world, it's going to be pretty hard to command people not to offer sacrifices? And why is that? I mean, I sit here and I think, like, is it that big a deal? Like, they're being asked to do a lot of different things, to leave Egypt, to worship this new God. So, I mean, what's the big deal? All right, let's hear from Samuel Friedman.
Hi there. So in terms of, you know, what does it take to change, you know, one's mindset here? It's like, yes, we're all been sacrificing all these animals, possibly for generations here. I also ask where and when was this command given? Okay, the Jews / Israelites just left Egypt. Were they doing all the animal sacrifice in Egypt? Okay, what's everybody else around them doing as well? And so it's clear to me that you know, they don't necessarily have the background of, you know, sacrificing animals in like a Jewish context, because, you know, they're just starting off as Jews. But I also think that they can change, and people do occasionally change. I mean, if you look at Mount Sinai, you know, what happens? We say, you know, we're going to change what we're doing. And it happens in fairly short order. Okay, maybe not overnight, but within, you know, a year or so, it seems like they're following what Moses says.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, this is an interesting way to think about human nature, that it's hard for people to go from one thing to the other. Sure, but it's contradicted by some of the major arcs of the Torah's narrative. Isn't Sinai itself a radical transformation of an entire people? Aren't they going from not keeping Shabbat to keeping Shabbat? There's so many things that they're being asked to change, you know, overnight. It's a strange idea. And Maimonides, right at the start, he said many, many of our laws can be explained this way. Not all of them, right? Because not all of the laws are just a continuation of the way things used to be. And as Samuel says, the way things used to be, as Maimonides is narrating it, is what it was like in Egypt. So we just sort of imagine this is the land, the infrastructure, the landscape, the customs and ceremonies they're used to. And so, you know, that's just the world they lived in, you know. But I mean, they literally, the whole point is they're leaving Egypt. That's the whole point, Egypt in particular. And yet Egypt's like sacrificial world is going to inform the Torah's own. Let me just say the thing here, which is so alarming to later commentators. There's something about this that suggests that the Torah isn't giving us the best system. The Torah is giving us what you call like a bidyeved, like a plan B, a kind of a concession. Okay, that's the main word here. The sacrifices are a concession to our nature, which is first of all rooted and grounded in whatever cultural context we're in, and second of all, you know, finds it very difficult to make a major transformation. Samuel says, I don't know, I see some major transformations in the Torah, so why is this the one place where you come and you say, oh no, they needed to evolve, and so it, you know, take it little by little. All right, let's hear from a couple of other thinkers, and then we'll head back to Maimonides. Let's hear from Matt Silverstein.
I've said this line before. I'm going to say it again. Frazier, Golden Bough, gives the line that ritual survives. I don't remember his wording, but ritual survives far longer than theology. Mm-hmm. Bullfighting is 3,000-4,000 years old. It was a Mycenaean religious rite. And the Pope is the pontiff, because that's the Pontificus Maximus, who is the priest of the bridges of Rome. And so they kept the title. We keep ritual. We find another thing for it to mean. And Jews do that. And in fact, I want to say it's an essential Jewish thing. Because long before I read Frazier, I did, what does this mean to me today? What is this about? It's not just the Seder, but we're always saying, I'm going to do this thing. Sacrifice the animal, eat the matzah, do the whatever. And I'm going to find some other thing that it means.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's a very, what Matt is saying here, I think is quite profound, because I feel it myself, that we are, just to restate some in a basic way, somewhere Matt started, that we are in some ways more attached to the rituals and the features and forms in our tradition than we are to the ideas. And by attached, I mean, it's harder for us to let go of our customs and practices. And he uses that word, Matt, Well, Maimonides used it, at least, I don't know, he wrote in Judeo-Arabic, so neither of these translations, neither of these is the original. But the word in the Hebrew that they're using is minhag, a custom. Those customs, those things that are just sort of the ways that we practice our behavior is hard to break, and maybe not our ideas. And that's, I think that's a quite a profound thing to say. That Matt's saying in the name of Frasier, but I know it to be true. I mean, I have all kinds of like prayers, ways of praying that I grew up with, little customs like that are grounded in, you know, things that I'm not so sure that I, you know, what's a good example? You know, I'm very particular to put on my shoes, right shoe, left shoe, tie left, tie right. There's all kinds of like seemingly like folk traditions that turned into Jewish like laws of like, you know, avoiding the eyes of the Satan, or, you know, like things that I don't like. He asked me what I really think my theology, this seems like that I don't really, but I've been doing it since I was like a kid, and I want to do, because it's just so in me, it's so deep in me, I want to, you know, like they're just like there are things that I am attached to because that's the way we used to do it, and I can't do otherwise. I'm that much I relate to, and I want to just give now that Matt has framed it in this way, I want to just like give the sort of second half of Maimonides' thought here. And we're going to skip a little and come back, because what we've said so far is it's impossible for a person to leave behind the practices that they know, and to go to the other extreme. So what is the answer then? What does Maimonides say? I'm going to come back here because he said something really interesting here, but I think it's like the next step. I just want to finish this thought, which is, for this reason, God allowed these kinds of services to continue. I think that's a typo, services to continue. God transferred. This is like really interesting language here. God transferred the God service. Sorry, God transferred to God's service that which had formerly served as a worship of created beings, like the sun. The sun was created, but you used to worship the sun with sacrifices. God transferred that kind of worship of things imaginary and unreal and commanded us to serve God in the same manner. That is, to build unto God a temple. Make me a sanctuary. Have the altar erected to God's name. To offer sacrifices to God, to bow down before God, okay? The priests who serve in the temple, well, there used to be priests, and there used to be donations to the priests. All of these things, all of Leviticus, the whole thing, which seems to us, you know, what do the academics call it? The sacrificial cult. You know, when you read academic books, you ever come across this, like, oh, we have to discuss the sacrificial cult. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm not in a cult, am I? What are you using that word? And I'm sure they're using it for, you know, precise academic reasons. But it's like, it does feel that way. Like the priests and the donations and all of this, like, feels very, and especially if you're Maimonides, a real rationalist who believes that like the true God experience happens in the mind. All of this seems like just, you know, barbaric, like ancient, and it looks a lot like idolatry. But he's saying, no, but that's the point. You took your idolatry and you just moved it over to God. Okay, like, very huge radical thing for Maimonides to say, and Matt has given us some way of appreciating, some logic for appreciating that. Like, we needed to do the thing. We're attached to the thing. To redirect the idea behind it, that we can do. That's easier, actually, for a person to do than to change the behaviors that they're so used to. Okay, interesting. David Kurtz.
I am so happy to be so in sync with Maimonides. I had no idea. you know, rework the genius of Torah is it, certainly in Genesis, it's a reworking of mythologies that were already there, put in a redirected and put in a context that's totally different to this story. Now, almost any story in Genesis is not an original story, the most famous being not only creation, but certainly flood stories, which were everywhere in the world. But when you recontextualize it and work that mythology towards a certain point, it's not until we get to Exodus that we're totally in original territory here. I've always looked at, talking about sacrifice, throughout the ancient Near East, and I think in Egypt too, there was child sacrifice. And I've always read the Akedah as a repudiation of child sacrifice. And what ends up being sacrificed? The ram. So, you know, I'm just so smiling to be so in sync with Maimonides. Thank you.
Great, great. Okay, good. Right, so David's in sync with Maimonides, and I'm glad to hear it, because this is like a whole school of thought. And that's part of what I want to... I wanted to talk about this because it's a very important piece, and it's always difficult for us to think about the sacrifices. This is one of the classic resources for, you know, for us to think about the sacrifices, but it is a radical position. It's a radical position, and I'll show you what a radical position is by giving you a, I want to give you the other voice in the tradition, the other voice, which belongs to Nachmanides in this case, and these two are often going at it. In fact, I think in Lech Lecha this year, we did another debate between Maimonides and Nachmanides. They're always fun to track. And Maimonides is in some ways the greater of the two. I mean, Nachmanides is commenting on his work. But Nachmanides is like, in some ways, the more traditional, the more hardcore of the two. And is going to, in his way, and we're not going to go through a lot. I just want to, all I want you to hear is the tone of his response. He's got his own explanation for the sacrifices, which we don't really need to study today. He's got, you know, the hidden mysteries within the sacrifices and all the reasons, and they're, you know, but listen to the language he uses before he introduces his own theory, just to hear Nachmanides here. Nachmanides says, oh boy, here we go. Okay. V'hinehem divrei havai. These words are preposterous. Havai is like worthless, empty, frivolous, stupid. You don't say that to Maimonides, okay? You don't say that to Maimonides, but he does if you're Nachmanides. V'hen divrei havai, these are preposterous. They attempt to heal a great fracture and answer a major question with a superficial answer. In other words, I admit that the problem is significant. Okay, this is a really important phrase here, because Nachmanides is also saying, I get it. It's hard for us to understand the sacrifices. It's a major question, but you're giving me a silly answer. You're giving me a silly answer, and you are making the table of the eternal. And there was a table in the tabernacle. So, but the table of the eternal in this case is the altar. You are making the table of the eternal a disgusting thing. This is goel nefesh. You're making it a disgusting thing. It's only there to deal with the hearts of the wicked and the fools of the world. Okay, I want you to just hear the response here. And now we're in a very major Jewish debate, and I wonder what side you will take. David Kurtz has taken Maimonides' side, but does anyone take Nachmanides' side? Like, what are you doing to our Torah here? It's all just like, well, you know how people are. They need to do idolatry, and we're just going to let the people do idolatry for as long as they need to, because what are you going to do? That's what it is, and we're actually doing an idolatrous act when we worship our God. This is actually base, low-level, ancient, archaic. Why would the Torah do that? This is the Torah. This is the word of God. Don't tell me that the sacrifices are just a concession. Is that nothing in the Torah is a concession? Okay, so now you see the debate here, and I see a lot of hands. So let's process it a little bit. But those are the stakes here. Is the Torah just a disgusting reenactment of stupid, foolish, wicked people's desires? Or is the Torah brilliantly dealing with the resistance that human beings have to change and sort of moving us slowly towards at least redirecting our wicked actions? Where we go from there is the next question, but let's just hover in that debate. The Torah wants to, like, cannot expect us to be, and this really is like what Yonatan is giving us here is a real a deep understanding of what Maimonides is saying, a kind of sympathetic understanding, a sympathetic to Maimonides and also sympathetic to us, that it really is true that you can't expect people to act perfectly all the time. You just can't. But what you can do is insist that they not go beneath the moral floor, that they not act like monsters, that they not act like idolaters, they not act the worst. That's all you can really expect. Treat your slaves nicely. Can the Torah come onto the scene and say, "Hey, world"? I mean, this is one of our, you know, you name one of our. I should have mentioned this one also. So thank you for this example. The first law in Mishpatim is you have to let a slave go after 6 years. How about no slaves? Like, we just finished Hebrew. How about no slaves? But again, a lot of the commentaries are, well, you can't have no slaves in a world where people literally sell themselves into slavery to pay their debts off. Like, that's the world. What are you going to do? Okay, so that's I think we really have to take that seriously, what Yonatan is saying, and by extension, what Maimonides is saying. Like, the Torah's not there to make us angels. The Torah's there to set a moral floor. Okay, let's hear from Jen.
You know, I mean, let's be real. The reason why we don't do temple sacrifices historically is because we don't have a temple. Like, it got destroyed. It's not because we as a people all developed a strong sense of animal rights and decided we no longer wanted to kill creatures. So much of our moral development historically is because of economic contingencies, cultural interactions. You know, like, it's not necessarily a story of us all becoming more and more enlightened. And we lose so much when we look back on our ancestors with the attitude that we are doing it better and we are more enlightened than they were. There's slavery in the world. Until a decade ago, we were getting diamonds from slaves in Africa, and many people still are. Our clothes come from practical slaves in China, in Bangladesh. Like, we are not better than our ancestors. And we are learning, if we pay attention, from our ancestors to relate to their striving for justice, even in those imperfections. Like, that's the piece that we can take out of this, is what were they doing within that context to move themselves toward justice? What was the spirit? What was the inspiration? And how did they use the language and tools of their time to do meaningful things that we can relate to? And I mean, this is an issue when we talk about 18th century literature or reading Harry Potter or all sorts of things, where do we take the art and beauty and wisdom from people who did problematic things? Or do we fixate on the problematic things and think that we're better?
This is great. This is like a whole, I mean, in some ways, Jen is kind of picking up on the themes that Yonatan was just working through. But in some ways, Jen offers us an entirely new theory here of Torah, which is to say that unlike Maimonides, let me put it the other way. Like Maimonides, Jen acknowledges that there are concessions to just the way things are, the way we are, the best of our ability to perceive. But unlike Maimonides, Jen doesn't necessarily see that as, and therefore, inevitable progress towards better and better and higher ideals. No, in fact, the Torah is telling us about human concession because we're all embedded in a social, cultural context. We're all limited by that. We all struggle. How do we worship now? And is this the highest form of worship? We were just trained to go into synagogues, and this is the way, you know, and someone will come along and say, like, that's not the ideal form of worship. But we're all just in our cultural context, and and I think, you know, what's particularly, I think, generous in what Jen is saying is that the best we can do is go back and try to understand why our people once related to sacrifices. And we can say we don't anymore, but it doesn't, that doesn't necessarily have to put them on a like backwards in the scale of progress and us forwards in the scale of process, in the scale of progress. I think that's a very, I want to just really hold that as a possibility. That's a distinct theory. Having said that, I do want to end with, I want to go back to Maimonides and just end with, Maimonides looks at it differently than Jen, and Maimonides really does see us moving towards greater and greater spiritual evolution. And he says something, remember I skipped earlier, I want to just go back and say, the whole thing of giving sacrifices to people who were only used to sacrifices, he says, is because they couldn't have just been told, start praying. They weren't used to praying with words. And he gives an example here, and this I just want us to think about as we leave the class today. He says, it's like, it was in accordance with the wisdom and plan of God, as displayed in the whole of creation, that God did not command us to give up and discontinue all these manners of service. Okay, that we know. For to obey such a commandment, it would have been contrary to the nature of man, who generally cleaves to that which to which he is used. We read that. Here's what we didn't read. It would in those days have made the same impression as a prophet would make at present if he called us to the servants of God and told us in God's name that we should not pray to God, nor fast, nor seek God's help in time of trouble, that we should serve God in thought and not by any action. Okay, that's a big thing for Maimonides to say. If someone came now and said, discontinue all your barbaric prayers, just meditate, just contemplate the oneness of God. Some of us might like that. I think Maimonides would have liked that. That's really where Maimonides like sees us going. The ultimate is to leave this behind too, and to get to higher and higher and higher forms of worship. But if someone came today and say, shut down all your synagogues, I've got the perfect Jewish meditation for you, that wouldn't happen. We wouldn't do that. You know, as we said earlier, as Matt said, we're attached to the forms. We want to go to shul. We're used to this now. And this becomes very relatable, but it also presents us with a very progressive vision of religious history, which is that we're moving towards some higher ideal, and we'll never go back. We'll never go back to the sacrifices. And then eventually we'll transcend this and we'll never go back. It's always progress, it's always higher. That's not a theory you have to buy, but I think it is embedded in Maimonides' philosophy and his philosophy of the Torah. So the debate continues, but I thank you all for your participation in it. Wish you a Shabbat Shalom, and I'll see you next week. Okay, that's it. A taste of our weekly Parsha class. I want to thank everyone who came to the class, some of whose voices you may have heard today, some you didn't because the podcast has been edited. So just want to thank everybody. And speaking of editing, I want to thank also our editor, Vera Blossom, for her great work. If you'd like to join our class sometime and come and join our circle of Torah geeks, you can find us again, Thursdays, 12 p.m. online at ikar.org. That's ikar.org. And if you go to the calendar, then you can find a Zoom link and just click in. And in the section on the website that we keep our classes, you can, if you click on Parsha Study, you'll find all of our archived classes and source sheets and everything we discuss there. So if you're looking for a regular Parsha class, I'd love to see you. And in the meantime, I will talk to you next week.